With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, I told you we're going to kick things off as we always do, having a look at the business stories of today and indeed earlier in the week. Delighted to be joined by Caroline Reedy and also by Doug Keating. Good morning to you both.
Morning. Morning, Bobby.
Now, let's start with the front page of the Irish Mail, Doug. We were told that Ireland was going to be the Saudi Arabia of wind many years ago, and we've got all this potential. But the headline in today's front page of the Daily Mail says that offshore wind hopes fall flat.
Yes, so Craig Hughes, the political editor of the Daily Mail, seems to have got his hands on a government report that's looking at the future potential for offshore wind in Ireland. And it seems that the quantum of offshore wind that we may be able to build could be a lot less than was hoped. The government have been hoping to do, I think it's 48 gigawatts, but this report suggesting might be under 18. So why can't we build all this offshore wind, you may ask? Well, apparently, according to this report, it's because a lot of the sea is too deep and or there is things on the seabed that will make it hard to build these wind farms. And I mean, why is this important? Well, I guess we, as a country, we're committed to halving our emissions by 2030, or potentially facing 20 billion euros in fines. And the story also has Jennifer Whitmore from the Social Democrats pointing out that by 2030, 30% of all the energy we produce may be used by data centers. And obviously, as we grow energy use, if we don't have the renewables to back it up, that's not going to be carbon friendly.
Yeah, this is, I actually think this is a disaster when you look at what the potential was here. Like, the only offshore wind that we have is on the Arklow Bank. I passed it twice this year out at sea, and the turbines were turned off.
Yeah, and it's telling us that they're needing to be recommissioned. So actually, the only one we have is no longer going to be one that we can use. I thought it was interesting too, Bobby, that in Galway, off the coast of Galway, where basically 30 turbines were in for planning, that basically they got 177 objections to Bord Pleanála, and basically they pulled their application. So it takes on average 9 years, we're being told, for one of these applications to be successful, which seems...
Well, as Doug mentioned there, 2030 is only around the corner.
Yeah, so it seems we're in trouble.
If we're going to be looking at fines of 20 billion. There's a real cost to not doing this.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to need something a lot more radical. The government got this report in May when they did this detailed mapping exercise. But I think the news in it is a shock to everybody. But it means now that they really need to radically reassess the whole situation here, because those data centres are obviously a huge drain, 30% of all of our energy. And ultimately, we've no plan B, it looks, so we're going to have to get our house in order.
Doug, DAA paying tax bill on directors' VIP perks, another splash, this time by John Mulligan. Not sure where he's getting his information, but it's quite interesting that the perks around the board of DAA, that the company is actually paying the benefit in kind associated with the use of this VIP travel lounge. So As I say, I'm not sure where the information came from, but
The backdrop, I guess, obviously the DAA's been in the news. There has clearly been a bust-up between the DAA's CEO and the board. There's been reports of a €1 million exit package being agreed for the CEO, Kenny Jacobs. The minister does not seem prepared to sign off on this, and Kenny Jacobs has said he's more than happy to continue in the role. Against this backdrop, miraculously, the newspapers have been told that the directors of the DAA, who apparently earned in fees last year about €205,000, also received €63,000 worth of benefits from using this VIP platinum lounge that apparently you get. Bobby, you've probably done this, I don't know, but chauffeur-driven car.
Someone told me about it. You get driven out to the plane and all.
Out to the plane and all this. And and actually the story reports, well, the Business Post apparently found out that Basil Gagan, the chairman of the DAA, has used this service 55 times in 2025. So he certainly is travelling a lot and using platinum. But the big thing, and Caroline and I, we discussed this, is they are getting if you get a benefit, you have to pay tax on it. It's like getting it's sort of an extra money. But the DAA is actually paying this tax for them, which seems wrong.
Yeah.
I would have thought that wasn't illegal.
Well, I suppose it's not illegal and it is disclosed in the annual report and it is subject to audit. But I suppose the whole idea of BIK is that it's any non-wage benefit. So for most people who get health insurance or gym benefits or anything like that, the tax liability is paid by the employee. So you equate whatever the value of the benefit is and you pay tax on it. And I suppose, being honest, the ordinary Joe Soap must do that and the ordinary employee does it every other day. So I think it's a bit Irish to think somebody who is well paid doing the job. There's nothing wrong per se, because as I say, it's been audited, etc. However, I think ethically and morally, there's an element of it's nearly a benefit in kind on top of
kind. That's what I was wondering. I mean, if you pay my benefit in kind, the tax on it, then I've got another benefit.
It's a vicious circle. So I think this is probably another little spotlight.
And it doesn't help in the context of what's going on here, clearly.
Yeah, but a €1 million exit package, you know, Darragh O'Brien has said, you need to go back, lads, and try and see, can you work this out? So it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because it has been on the agenda for quite a while now in terms of stalemate, because it's a big deal if the board and the CEO aren't working in the same direction.
Clearly, if the CEO is saying, well, I'm quite happy to stay and I'm not quite happy to work through this.
Yeah, he's 3 years into his 7 year.
So this has been going on for too long as it stands.
Absolutely. And like 4 more years of this, I think, is something that they need to resolve fairly soon. But I do think as well, a €1 million payout is taxpayers' money. That can't be that easily just, you know, deciding that we're going to break up when that cost is involved.
Somebody's going to need to blink at some stage.
Yeah, Caroline up there to sort them out.
A bit of mediation.
I was interested in the synopsis in Cancelling in the Irish Times this morning, that one third of earners don't actually pay any income tax, and that's fine. But I think the piece here is sort of saying, really, if you look at how the tax take is balanced among society, that we're very vulnerable here to a couple of shocks, both on the corporation side and on the high earners paying tax, that both of those are probably linked. So if we were to get a headwind or a speed bump in terms of the big corporates that pay out most of that corporation tax, it could be quite significant for the economy in total.
Yeah, and look, I think this article is sort of a reminder of a couple of things, that the Irish tax system, for all the complaints of some of the left, is actually highly progressive, and people who earn more money pay more tax, which is right and proper. But it's actually at very high levels. So the top 10% of earners pay 40% of all income tax and 60% of all USC. And as you pointed out in your introduction, and it's the headline of the article, a third of tax units, as they're called, apparently a tax unit is it could be an individual or a couple, but 1.2 million people don't actually pay any net income tax at all once you kind of have account for tax credits. So we are hugely reliant on these high earners. And the second thing is obviously corporation tax. 10% of companies are responsible for 60% of corporations.
10 individual companies.
No, well, 10% of 10 individual companies. Sorry, you're correct. Yeah. Thank you. Are responsible for 60%. So, you know, and they're probably paying quite a lot of the high earners. So, as you say, it's sort of linked. And this report from the Department of Finance is just making, you know, slightly obvious point, I guess, that we are vulnerable. If something goes wrong, we've got a tax bonanza at the moment, I think, Caroline, you were saying when we were chatting earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, will it be here forever?
Well, yeah. what it's saying, Caroline, is, I suppose the summation is, the narrowness of Ireland's tax base has been highlighted for several years, including in a high-profile report by the Commission on Taxation. So, as Doug says, this is stuff we already know.
It is indeed. And I suppose because we have a bit of a tax bonanza at the moment, obviously this whole problem is a what if, you know, there is an issue with these multinationals, etc. Because let's be, you know, most of those 10 companies equate for a lot of those big earners as well. So if something is to crack, ultimately it'll have a domino effect. But I suppose it's a typical bell curve that we would expect to see. And it's good to see that 10% of the top earners are paying most of the tax. But I think it's those US multinationals making up 60% of those corporation tax receipts is where we really need to be conscious to see, make sure that that doesn't in any way waver, because otherwise those tough decisions will become very much on the agenda.
Yeah. Interesting as well to see, I suppose, a table almost of the state company dividends to Exchequer reached almost 440 million over the last 2 years. And I think there's been some comment. Martin Wall has a good piece on this today in the Irish Times. But really, again, Doug, about if the ESB is paying in 230 million to the Exchequer, should some of that money be redeployed to improving the national grid? In other words, should there be a link with where the dividend is coming from and the reinvestment per se?
Well, it's interesting. The Social Democrats, in fairness, have been out on manoeuvres recently, because the first story we talked about was to do with renewable energy, and we had Jennifer Whitmore, you know, expressing concerns about the amount of data centres we had and the lack of renewable energy that might be to power them. This story is prompted by, I think, a question from the Social Democrats. Aidan Farrelly, where he, you know, he is saying this money from dividends, of which totaled 440 million over the past 2 years, he's saying that should be ring fenced into a fund for energy security and investment in the grid. Look, it's an argument you can make. I think if you get into this, you know, ring fencing pockets of money here, pockets of money there, ultimately governments need to sit down and make priorities. And yes, we do need to invest in our infrastructure, but I'd be dubious about the idea of ring fencing, particularly semi-state company dividends.
I thought some of the numbers were interesting, Caroline. Like Bord na Mona is still chipping in 13.3 million. And again,
the reinvented Bord na Mona, you know.
Yeah.
That's substantial income coming into the government.
Absolutely. Gas Network Ireland, 62 million. Dublin Port, 6 million. So they vary, I suppose, depending on the institute. But ultimately here, what the government are now looking to do is to basically set up a shareholders' expectation framework around this dividends policy, so that they basically, as a plan, to say, this is what we can expect as a shareholder. I suppose, arguably, it depends on the organisation as to whether you think that's good, bad or indifferent. Airvia, 44 million, is up there with them as well. But I think what we're interested in as well is, you know, what are they doing with this money now? And I think that's what the Social Democrats are saying. Is it just going back into the pot when we see ultimately we need to do a lot more radical work here?
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Some news from Stena Line. They're going to add a second ship on the Dublin-Liverpool freight. Interesting, because I think people were kind of surprised when Stena Line announced the cancellation of its Rosslare-Cherbourg service back in June, when people thought that. But this is it's almost telling another story, isn't it, Caroline?
It is indeed. I think the big story here is that post-Brexit customs clearance is less complex than expected. And in this really good interview with the CEO of Stenaline, basically he outlined that, look, we put in place the Rosslare-Cherbourg ferry as a contingency because we expected that the Brexit customs would be more complex and we'd need that as a backup. Whereas what they've learned is they currently have two crossings a day since February from Dublin to Liverpool, and it's working really, really well. Hence, they're looking to add a second ship to the route. And also, I suppose what they're saying is that ultimately the road network around Rosslare is presenting challenges, and they feel that investing in the Dublin-Liverpool option is a better one. But good news all around, I think, with the post-Brexit customs clearance.
I mean, and I guess the if one ship is doing two trips a day, I mean, presumably a second ship maybe means it's four trips a day. But I guess if you're going to Liverpool, it's not just exports going into the UK, that is opens up the land bridge into Europe. So presumably some of that traffic that would have gone to Cherbourg will instead go into Liverpool and then down through the UK.
It also tells you that, you know, commerce will find its own level. So if companies can make it work by going through the UK, and clearly this is an example, the complexity of the administration around customs clearance and all that seems to have been somewhat demystified.
I mean, remember how, I mean, and I don't think we were wrong to be worried, but when Brexit was happening, you know, it there was a period where you just thought, how is this going to work? It's all going to fall to pieces. So it is good to read that, as you say, business has found a way and things are not as complicated as we had feared.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know if you're a regular taxi user, Caroline, but I've been quite interested in this story that's been rambling on for the last number of weeks, which is about Uber and fixed fare charges for taxi drivers.
Indeed, I got a taxi this morning and he was filling me in as well on this tactical story.
Did he have an issue with it?
A little bit of an issue, all right.
Sometimes one doesn't really want to hear the taxi driver's perspective on things, but, you know, there's a good Q&A, which I suppose
there is,
sort of demystifies what's the issue here. And then there's an interesting piece by John McManus, who wittingly says that he didn't know that taxi drivers could offer discounts.
Yeah.
He never asked for one or never got one.
Yeah.
But what's intriguing to me here is that, you know, dispute is with Uber, yet a huge number of taxi drivers use Uber.
Absolutely.
So they're kind of fighting with themselves.
Yeah, like they're two good stories, and I do think they've done a good job kind of demystifying the whole thing. So Uber was launched in San Francisco in 2011, and I suppose it really is very widely used. I was in Boston earlier this year, and Uber, like literally the amount of people that do it as a second job, you know, whatever they're doing, they just do this on the side and earn really good money. And I suppose in this scenario, a third of Ireland's 18,000 taxi drivers are signed up to Uber. I was amazed 93% of them use FreeNow, so obviously that's a big part of
it. That's owned by Lyft, which is an Uber competitor.
You're spot on.
Yeah.
And ultimately what Uber are saying is they're going to introduce dynamic pricing. So they're going to give you the option that you can use the meter or you can choose a fixed fare based on the time of day, the demand, etc. However, the taxi drivers are saying that moving away from their fixed meter pricing means that they're potentially going to be earning less. Now, arguably, you could suggest then, well, maybe they just don't use Uber as a platform and stick with FreeNow and stick with the meter. But ultimately, I suppose that's...
As long as they continue to use the platform, they're going to get nowhere.
Absolutely.
But I mean, FreeNow, I was reading in the article, does use this kind of pricing in other markets. And I guess what John McManus's article is asking the question, you know, this could simply be Uber trying to win some market share off FreeNow by offering this pricing, which I guess is the consumers must use it because they feel it's cheaper.
But initially, that's what the point I think we're hearing.
Well, yes, it puts, I guess the taxi drivers are saying, you know, ultimately if people pull out of the market, then there won't be enough taxis and fares will go up. But John McManus's question is really, is this Uber kind of just trying to get some market share, or is ultimately Uber is pushing for the casualization of taxi driving that Caroline described in the US, where it's people doing, you know, they might do 3 hours in an Uber, be doing another job, Which you know, I think taxi drivers.
Well, I don't think the law allows that, Doug.
Not at, no, but yeah, but I mean, yeah. Uber. You can. I would bet your bottom dollar that you know Uber's long-term game plan is to achieve that in the Irish market.
Sure.
And I can. I think taxi drivers are rightly, you know, concerned about that. It's their livelihood. But as you say, they are using the Uber app, so you know they need to vote with their feet and get off it, because nothing tells a big corporate what to do better than saying, I ain't using your service.
It's a big PR element for Uber as well, isn't it? I think we're all talking about it right now.
Okay, I thought we'd finish on this one. I don't normally go to the travel sections of the newspapers on a Saturday morning, but there was a piece by Jeannie Harrison in the Mail that caught my eye. Why I love airplane food. Caroline.
I think what was most interesting in this was that an Oxford professor showed that you basically your taste buds are less than the 30% less effective when you're in the air due to the pressure. And, you know, humidity, etc. So no matter what,
tastes good.
Absolutely. And I think, to be fair, over the years, food has improved quite a lot. And it's great to see even in a lot of flights now, you get some Irish element of food as well. So I think they're doing a good job. And I think ultimately what Jeannie Harris is saying is we're not doing too bad. And then if you're lucky enough to be on one of the really nice flights, you're doing particularly good.
She also says, and again, it's worth pointing out, that all flight food, it has to be prepared en masse in a catering facility before it's repacked, blast chilled, refrigerated, and regenerated on board. So there's
it's kind of a miracle in a way.
There's four or five processes there.
That actually, when you peel back the silver foil, I mean, yes, maybe it's just some reheated pasta and you get your little, orange juice and your crackers or whatever. But I mean, it is almost amazing that it gets there at all. And I kind of share Jeannie Harrison's fond affection for the food I might eat on a flight.
Well, the other thing that I associated with is, sometimes when you're eating airline food, you're going on holidays. And, you know, I don't mind having a glass of wine out of a plastic glass and eating maybe lukewarm pasta or whatever it is, because I'm going to some place.
Really
I'm
nice.
Feeling good. And I'm saying, isn't this great? Even though it's only all right.
Yeah. And I mean, we've got so used to on sort of short haul and low cost airlines that we get nothing. Actually, if you are on a flight and someone puts a meal in front of you, it's almost a shock that this still happens. You know, this is fantastic.
Isn't it great? We're giving such good praise now to airline food this morning.
Yeah, so. And just to close out on it, it says that there's no point in using Michelin star chefs because it's at the very point that it's going to taste bland anyway.
I think that's it's kind of a branding exercise, isn't it?
It's probably the placebo effect, isn't it?
You heard it here, folks. All the good stories of the week. My big thanks, as always, to Doug Keating and Caroline Reedy. Thank you both for joining me this morning.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.